sort of en route.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be able to evaluate that later, what that means.
One of your performance measures will be...
Of all things, when we have the benchmark, the progress board here to see how, tell us how everyone else is doing, you certainly have a good point you can take the legislature on.
Thank you,
Jeff.
Would
you
for the
please,
record,
identify yourself
record,
for the subcommittee?
My name is Jeff Tryon, Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. And I have to apologize right away. The handout for your slide says measuring up benchmarks and information management. I would say information management and technology. So we had a little mix-up this morning. And
we'll note that in your benchmark, too.
Okay, thank you, sir. What I'd like to do is just, I'm just going to skip through the first few slides because you're very familiar with the Progress Board and how it started and who governs it and benchmarks and so forth. I would note that one of the things that's unusual about the Progress Board in Oregon is that we do set targets and we do judge ourselves against those targets and the Progress Board will be issuing its biennial report card in about probably 3 weeks. We'll be coming out with how we did on the benchmarks since 1998. So just a heads up for you on that. The other thing is that since the last time the legislature met, I've probably engaged with about 1,000 Oregonians around the process and how we set targets and what the benchmarks are, and that's a major part of our ongoing citizen involvement process, if you will. This really is something that lots of Oregonians have been involved with. I want to look at kind of three areas, and I had a little trouble getting a handle on just exactly what you're going to be looking at this committee, so I took a kind of a broad scope instead of a narrow. So I split my areas up into three, the kind of looking at the new economy as it relates to technology, looking at education levels and what we need in Oregon in order to continue to move towards a more technological-oriented economy, and then looking at technology itself, both in what little we have on this in the private sector and then state government. So that's how I'll organize my remarks. In the new economy side, I want to look at four of the benchmarks, one of which is new. Well, we'll look at venture capital, R&D, economic diversification, and then this new measure we have, which is the cost of doing business in Oregon. What happened to my slides? Jeez, I'm sorry. My machine went.
You know, by the way, Jeff, why don't we tell people if you want to take your chairs and angle around in any way, feel free to do so you can be observing what's going on here, too. I think it would be much more. And you can just pick your chair up and move it around if you want to sit over here. We're not going to be very formal. I'd prefer that you be able to see what's going on.
We couldn't sort of get the screen, so it works. But the other thing, Senator, if you like, is I could turn the screen a little bit.
Why don't you do that? Because we won't worry about these members on this side who don't show up. You know what? No. It's kind of hard. No, this is...
Okay. How's that? Okay. Great. Wonderful. So, as you know, we have 92 of these benchmarks in all. And so, what I've done is I've tried to choose the ones that are most relevant to the work of this committee. Why venture capital? Well, a lot of Oregon's economic growth in recent years has been very dependent on venture capital, and the technological orientation of the economy is what has allowed us to attract so much more venture capital to Oregon. In 1999, we ranked as the 10th most venture capital intensive state in the United States per capita. We will probably, I'm actually going to recommend to the board that we change the target because the board currently has a target of being 1 through 5, but we know the top 4 states are pretty well slotted in, and we're not going to move ahead of Massachusetts, for instance, or Washington. So we're probably going to change that and move it up to 5 through 10 as the area that we feel like we need to be in. But as you can see, we've been in the top 10 to 15 on average for most of the 1990s. Research and development is one of the keys in Oregon Shines. You know, much of Oregon Shines is about what we have to do in Oregon to allow us to take advantage of this new economy and the technological changes that are occurring in Oregon and in the United States. And one of our analysis says that Oregon can only be successful in the long term in the new economy if we do a substantial amount of R&D. In other words, we can't just be a high-tech manufacturing state, or we will end up having the same cyclical problems with the economy that we historically had, being a resource extraction state. We need to have a substantial amount of R&D in Oregon. If you look at Washington, our neighbor, Washington invests about 3% of its gross state product in research and development. The U.S. average is 2%, and Oregon has just moved up to 1%. So, Senator.
Jeff, I have a question. We look at something like this, the R&D, obviously that's in the private sector.
Right.
Do you look at a state role of what the state is to try to encourage an increase in that, or how do you, what's our responsibility as a state government?
Mr. Chair, actually one of the things that we've just done, because it's so important, is that we've added academia to R&D. So now we look at private R&D and then R&D that comes out of academia, because we believe that is a place where state government can play a very important role, because in a lot of those lead states, like Massachusetts, for instance, you find that academically begun R&D spawns more private sector R&D. So we think that there's a very close relationship between higher education's involvement in research and development and what happens with the private sector. So we will, in fact, begin this year tracking academic research and development as well as private. If you went to the folks who do R&D in this state, I'm sure there are things that they would be willing to talk to you about in terms of tax policy, et cetera, that would encourage it. But we believe that strengthening our academic involvement, research and development, is really one of the strongest things that we as a state can do. You'll see the target is to get up to just the national average. So you have to think about that for a minute. Oregon is only at half the U.S. average state right now for private R&D within the state. We are not historically a big research and development state. And most of this is on the development side and not the research side. Research is really pretty new for us. Technology has not helped us that much in our economic diversification. We have certainly seen a significant change in the economy, but because our technological development has been only concentrated in a few sectors primarily, it hasn't really diversified the economy very significantly. We're still just about number 30, so we're right in the middle of the pack. We're not one of the most diversified states by any stretch of the imagination. Oregon has seen a significant increase in labor productivity during the 1990s. That is primarily because of technology. When we see from this new index that we have, which comes from an outfit called Regional Finance Associates, and they do this index for every state, so we're ranking ourselves against other states, and that's where we're moving more and more with the benchmarks, is how do we compare with others? And that allows us to have a standard that's more than just self-generated, if you will. So Oregon has seen a significant reduction in labor costs as seen by the private sector, and that is primarily a result of the technological increase in productivity that has occurred in high technology. So high-tech workers are much more productive per unit of output than our historical workforce. So technology has played a significant role in reducing Oregon's national rank in the cost of doing business. The others, just for your information, that are part of that index is that they also look at tax costs, and that's a combination of both personal and corporate taxes. They have an index, which this is a very hard one to measure because you have to sort of put all the states on the same standard. But Oregon has also seen a reduction in its tax cost in terms of the cost for business in this state. We dropped pretty dramatically during the mid-1990s. And not surprisingly, Oregon's chief economic advantage in this index is energy cost, which, as we know, will be changing.
Has changed,
and will be changing further. But Oregon, over, as you can see, the whole 1990s has been ranked either second or third in terms of energy costs as a competitiveness factor. Now, this in the index only counts for 10%. Taxes count for 15%, labor counts for 75%. So that labor increase in productivity has been the primary contributing factor to Oregon reducing its cost of doing business relative to other states. A major improvement. Moving on to education, I want to look at a few variables there. Our technology sector was fed, and I know you've probably heard me say this before, but it's important to repeat. Our technology sector was in a major way fed by the education level of in-migrants who moved to this state during the 1990s. We know that during the 90s, 40% of everyone who moved to this state had a college degree. In 1990, only 23% of all Oregonians had that. So in-migrants have actually moved up our education level. At the same time, if you look through 1996 and 1997, Oregon, both private and public higher ed, didn't graduate a single additional college graduate. That is, we in 1997 were producing the same number of college graduates, absolute number, than we did in 1990. So much of that increase in our education level came from our highly educated in-migrants. That increase has stopped. We saw when we did the 2000 population survey that education level had started to fall a little bit. So we're coming down from that high of about 40%, which was really helping to drive our economy through the technologically trained portions of the in-migrant stream who were moving to Oregon to take a lot of the technology jobs that our industries were creating. So we're going to fall off in terms. We had hoped to have our overall population at about 32% by the year 2000. As you can see, we flattened out at 29% in 1996 and haven't increased since then. So we saw some nice increases during the early 90s and seen nothing since. Associate degrees are also very important to the technology sector. Intel would like to hire thousands more technologically oriented community college graduates if they had them. And we see in the general population that number has hovered around 3 to 4% of all Oregon adults who have an associate degree. So it's still quite a small number. We were hoping to see a pretty steady increase there when we started this out, but associate degrees haven't really expanded the way we'd hoped. Now, one of the problems is, and this is when we go to community colleges and ask them why, they say during the last 4 or 5 years, the economy has been so hot that you didn't have to finish your associate degree in order to get the job that you wanted. So you got the training you needed. You didn't actually obtain the degree, so you don't appear on the...
Excuse me. Senator Courtney, we're suggesting you take a seat here so you can see that screen better. Yes. By the way, I am going to... called the full committee of the joint, not the Information Management Technology Committee, to order. You're certainly welcome, Senator. Senator Courtney has joined us.
So this is an issue for us, but it may not be as large an issue as these statistics would say. There are quite a few people, as I said, who've gotten associate degree training but just haven't stayed long enough to get their actual associate degree.
I was at Clackamas Community College just recently in one of their technical programs, and they were telling me, in fact, I was meeting with the students, almost every student who just entered the program had already been hired, and they were a part of work in progress with some company at that particular point. Every one of them.
Right.
They said they had been offered a job immediately.
I think one of the things we don't understand very well as a state is why more young people aren't getting involved in that, because it's a very good job. It's not only a well-paying job, but it's a nice working environment. You have lots of opportunities, and yet we can't fill the seats, and we just have a huge demand there, which is not being filled by Oregonians, and that's I think a real issue for us that we need to grapple with more. We also ask, as part of the population survey, we ask the people that we call whether they have gotten at least 20 hours of skills training. This is not sort of emergency kind of CPR, et cetera, but skills training on the job, which is what the Progress Board understands is a standard that we ought to be using to judge how well the existing workforce is continually being trained up. And we found that that number has not increased from around 30%, just a little over. And one year we went up to 38, but generally we're around 33%. The trend line would be pretty flat, and we're not seeing an increase in training, which is another area that we would like to see, which is the private sector doing more training of their existing employees. Oregon enjoys a relatively high adult literacy rate. We did a literacy survey in 1990, and we're asking the legislature to fund another literacy survey for 2002, where we go out and randomly test the literacy of Oregonians, of Oregon adults. We go and knock on their door, we go into their houses, and they take a literacy test. What we found in 1990 was about just under 40% of Oregonians would qualify as having intermediate literacy. Now, that means that they're able to read things that are somewhat complex. They're able to understand a bus schedule. They're able to understand the doctor's instructions about how to administer a medicine for their child, those kinds of things. This isn't high-level literacy, but it's also not kind of the basic. So 40%, interestingly enough, was a pretty good number for the nation. So we were, I think, as I recall, in the top 10 to 15 states with that rate. So we haven't got another observation yet, because it's very expensive to do these literacy surveys, so we're hoping to get another one in 02 to see where that number is going. This is the bedrock fundamental measure of workforce in Oregon.
Well, I recall during the 80s, we were generally jumping between first and second in literacy rate in the nation. At that particular period.
Well, we're not. I don't think we're first and second anymore, Senator.
Well, that's what happens when I left office.
Well, let's think about that for a moment, Senator. The people that were in the 90 test were 25 and older, which might have been in school during your administration.
Let those people move in. You better go ahead and move on. You were doing better before.
Thank you, Senator. Let's look at a couple of technology issues. And we don't have a lot of these in the benchmarks, but let me just review what we have. This is actually a number we get from the population survey, which is we ask our households whether they have a personal computer within the house. And we saw a dramatic jump between 98 and 2000 of going from about half of all households to 70% of all Oregon households now have a personal computer within their house. That's up from about 45% in 1994. We know that 60% of all households have internet access. So we're really getting wired up, if you will, very quickly. We saw that same dramatic increase between 1998 and 2000 for internet access. So most everybody who has a computer now has it hooked up with the internet. And lastly, in terms of the benchmark, I want to just speak for a minute about public management. This is our own information management quality within state government. I don't know if you're all familiar with the Governing Magazine ranking that came out 2 years ago. The new one will be out on January the 30th. Oregon overall received a B- for public management quality. And here are the rankings between Oregon and the 50-state average. I might note that the only place where we got above an average grade was managing for results. And we see down near the bottom, if we look at information technology, that Oregon got a C+, which was an average grade. We were pretty heavily criticized for not having a centralized system for information management. The new report, as I said, will be out in about a week, and Oregon will get a little bit lower grade than we got in 1999. So that grade's going to go down a little bit. I've seen the rankings, but I'm not allowed to share them yet because they're going to try and make a big splash with it. But that ranking, as I said, will be out on the 31st, and I think you'll see information technology being a little worse than it was in 1999. I just want to close with a couple of slides on the other side of the equation, which is the benchmarks are kind of the reality side, if you will. We also do a series of questions with Oregonians about how they perceive public services in Oregon. So we asked them, how good a job do you think Oregon is doing at providing community college services, providing parks, four-year college and education? These are the 2000 numbers. Just a couple of quick highlights. You can see that community colleges is and has been, ever since we started, the top-ranked service in Oregon. 91% of all Oregonians see community colleges as doing a good or excellent job. Parks is number two. Oregonians love their parks. 90% of all Oregonians. Four-year colleges and universities are doing much better. They've actually improved significantly. If we go down to the fifth one there, we ask them about all government, and we find that 78% of Oregonians think that all government is generally doing a good or excellent job. That's a surprise to a lot of people. Right under that is creating jobs. We've got about 78% of Oregonians who think that we're doing a pretty good job at job creation now. I'll let you read the rest of those yourself unless you have any questions. I would note that the only one that we're still under the 50% mark is our ability to reduce the use of drugs. If you look at the change that occurred between 94 and 2000, we see, and this is actually the percentage they had in 94 versus the percentage they had last year. You see that the biggest increase that we've seen in public perception of the public sector's ability to get things done is in crime. We've seen a 33% increase in public's view of how well Oregon fights crime. The second largest increase was in Oregon's ability to create jobs, which has a lot to do with the technology sector and with the change in Oregon's economy. We only saw two reductions, and they're modest, which is Oregon's ability to maintain roads and bridges and Oregon's ability to provide health care, and then a very small one in air and water, but that's a quite high ranking, and it's only a 1% change. So that's my remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions, or if I can, I'll be happy to come back with the answer.
Okay, questions to the committee. Yes, Senator Courtney.
Chair, Mr. Tryon, the 60% hookup to the Internet, is that across the state or is that predominantly in the Valley and Portland?
Senator, we haven't broken those numbers down by region yet, but I would be happy to find that out for you.
The survey Oregon Population Survey, when was it done, please?
It was done in May through July of 2000.
And the sample, please?
The sample is 4,000 households.
And I assume it was done statewide as well?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Is that Tim Hibbett's group?
I'm sorry?
Is this Tim Hibbett's group, the other Oregon Population, is that who did it?
Senators Bardsley and Neidhart, which is a polling firm out of Portland. This is quite an extensive survey.
And this is exactly how they broke it down. For example, did they subdivide crime into adult crime versus juvenile crime?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cornyn, we just asked them a general question. How good a job do you think Oregon is doing at fighting crime? So, no, there wasn't a split up between adult and juvenile. I'll be happy to get you the regional breakdown, though, for the internet hookup.
That's relevant to this committee, Mr. Chair, because of 622. Senator Nelson here from Pendleton would say that's one of the things we were trying to do in 622, although I probably voted against it, was to move cable, to, you know, try to, like, the whole government thing on our internet commission is to try to come up with places throughout the state where we can spread the word outside of this area into the hinterland. So I'm curious to know about this 60% figure. It has relevance in terms of what's going on in eastern and central Oregon and the far reaches of Oregon. That's why I'm asking the question.
I'd be happy to get that for you, Senator.
Jeff, I have a question, and maybe you answered that. Maybe I didn't hear it right. You say technology jobs have helped change perceptions about job creation.
Mm-hmm.
Technology jobs, okay.
Well, that is jobs in the technology sector is where, in my reading of this, why Oregonians think we're doing such a good job at creating jobs, why that number has increased so much, because there have been so many jobs and so much expansion of the technology sector.
Well, I just was trying to understand why the technology dealt with with drug use, for example.
Mm-hmm. No, this is, I'm sorry, Senator, this
is... Is there something wrong with...
I just have a circle around the job creation
I'm
one.
I'm sorry,
yes.
There's no connection with...
No, with the rest of them. That's why I was trying to highlight...
The heading was throwing me a little.
I was trying to highlight the job perception.
I'm sorry, okay. Yeah, I knew there was a logical thing that I wasn't picking up on. Other questions for Jeff? Jeff, I guess the question I might ask of you would be, as you look at the benchmarks from various agencies and government and other entities, where does technology fit into the benchmarks, and how are we doing? Do you have that information?
Senator, when you say technology, tell me a little bit more about what you mean.
Well, I guess an agency has set some benchmarks, and maybe the Justice Department, they plan to increase the ability to provide information and so forth. Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. Okay. And now where are they? And I assume that they're planning to utilize technology, because I happen to know that they're planning to do something. Mm-hmm. Will that show up in the benchmarks anyplace?
Senator, the only place that would show up is in something like a performance management review like Governing Magazine does. We only have a couple of benchmarks that relate to state government per se.
Yes, well.
But I would say, if I might, that there are there is a new resource for that would be worth looking at, which is the database that the Department of Administrative Services and legislative fiscal are requiring agencies to submit their performance measures to, could be looked through to see where things like cycle time improvement are specified, because those are often places where technology is at the next level down. The way we're going to improve our cycle time is that we're going to automate the process, those kinds of things.
See, I'm starting to see those now in Ways and Means in their report that they're coming to us with their budget preparation. And it's going to show how they plan to use technology to increase their productivity or their service to people, et cetera. not always cost save, some cost savings, right. In some cases, just better service to people. Now, that's showing up there, but that's not picked up in your benchmarks. You're not showing, you're not monitoring that part of it.
Senator, in the 92 Oregon benchmarks, there is no measure of state government productivity per se, which is really what heading that would come under, other than the Governing Magazine five-part assessment. We are, on the other hand, if I might add, agency by agency, doing some analysis of performance measures, where those things sometimes come out.
Okay,
but it's not in the benchmarks except for that one measure that I just showed you a minute ago.
And I assume it's a bit misleading because we use that term benchmark in a number of places.
Right.
You've got your 92, but they're also using that terminology.
Well, we're actually trying to change the terminology a little bit. Can I just spend a minute? The Oregon benchmarks are the 92 measures. Those are sort of the formal high-level measures. The state just promulgated language, if you will, that all agencies are required to use, and you should be hearing this in Ways and Means now, where we have what we call high-level outcomes, intermediate outcomes, and outputs. And those are the three phrases we're using to talk about results. Outputs are things that agencies control. It's their widgets. It's what they do for a living. High-level outcomes are stuff like the benchmarks, these high things. And then the intermediate outcomes help bridge the gap, because that's the issue we've always had, is agencies say, you know, how can you hold us responsible for the benchmark on whatever? It's way out of our realm of influence. So we've been working with agencies to develop these intermediate things, which they and their partners influence, which are on the way towards the benchmarks. So, for instance, let me give you just one real quick example. With the governor's expansion of the pre-K program, what we knew was we wanted that to impact children coming to school ready to learn. That's really what we cared about. Pre-K helps these kids come to school ready to learn. We measure ready to learn now, so we know what that number looks like. When we went to the Department of Ed to talk to them about sort of what measures they would use to judge their success, they were much more oriented towards process measures, the kinds of things that the department has control over. So we negotiated an intermediate level measure, if you will, that said, okay, we and our partners are all going to take responsibility for increasing the completion rate of children who enter a pre-K program, because that is something that we can all influence. And we know that even if that kid gets through the pre-K, it doesn't mean they're absolutely going to be coming to school with the attributes they need, but we know they have a much better chance. And that's not anything that the Department of Ed would have ever been naturally willing to sign up for, because even that's well out of their control. But they and their partners can say, okay, this is how we're going to judge ourselves, by how many kids we are able to successfully get through the program. And that would be called an intermediate outcome. So that's where we've been working, trying to strengthen those measures that help to bridge the gap between the outputs of an agency and the benchmarks that is what Oregonians care about.
Well, I've been thinking about members of the committee as I've been sitting on those committees, and when they've been talking about, they use the term benchmark and so forth, I kept thinking, you know, this is something that the IMT committee should heighten our awareness of what's going on within many, many agencies throughout the state government, because actually the goal is to improve service.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And that's what we should be looking at. Well, any other questions for Jeff?
Yes,
Senator Courtney.
Ms. Tynes, I noticed that you've written document in your words that the overall average information technology rating for the nation is a B minus, and our overall average is a B minus.
Mm-hmm.
And you've indicated that that's going to go down a little bit, which will be known in a few days. And since you said a little bit, that obviously means it's not going to be a D or an F, so it means it's going to be in the C category.
Senator, that would be your interpretation. I'd say that would be pretty accurate.
This was just Senator Courtney's statement, right.
That's right. I mean, I gently moved him into
right.
that.
No, I think
but I did.
You were gentle enough.
The C's, there's all kind of C minus C plus C.
All kind of C's. Senator
all kind of C. But it's C. It's not D or F. But it's got to be a C if it's not a D or F, because it's already a B minus. Because I did that, Mr. Chair, that's...
Yeah, I took logic at one time. It just fell right into place.
That's a...
Anything else for Jeff? All right. Jeff, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here.
Sure, thank you very much. And yep. We'll get you that information, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Ms. Trent.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, we're pretty much on schedule. Thank you very much, Jeff, for keeping us there. I'm going to ask if Maynard Orme would come forward and Bill Swindells from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Maynard is the director, and Bill is the chair of the board of directors. And appreciate you folks taking time today. Again, Jeff, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Senator.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Folks, identify yourselves for the record.
I'm William R. Swindells. I am presently the board chair of Oregon Public Broadcasting.
And I'm Maynard Orme, president and CEO of Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we've been invited here today to give you a view of digital television, the conversion to digital from analog, and how that will affect, particularly how it will affect Oregon Public Broadcasting. I am here, as my understanding, you were more interested in the view of a relatively informed layman than a technician. So,
with all due respect to our
and, so I want to start by kind of giving you an overview, and then we'll defer to the far better informed, not a layman, but for Mayor, for some specific examples. Oregon Public Broadcasting, as I think you're all aware, is an independent nonprofit, formerly a state agency. We are dedicated to the universal and free distribution of radio and television to the citizens of Oregon, and with the intent of informing, educating, and enriching those users, the difference being from commercial media that they broadcast information to attract eyeballs to advertising. So we think the quality and the value to the user is distinctly different because of the structure and the mission that we have. Digital broadcasting is coming upon us. It is a part of a federal mandate, and it is in terms of economy or engineering, it is a very reasonable mandate. It is not a funded federal mandate, which would have helped us a great deal. And it is, without getting into the technicalities, as you've seen car phones go to, or cell phones go to digital, as you've seen record albums go the way of CDs, it is part of that general digital conversion. And as all things convert to computer and digital mode, we must convert the carrot and the stick. The carrot is really what we'll be able to do with digital. The stick is that we lose our license if we do not broadcast digitally. Oregonians presently and in the future, as we convert, will about 95% of Oregonians receive television right now. In the future, they will receive a greatly enhanced television service. Again, a point I like to make, digital conversion is not about a prettier picture. High-definition television is not synonymous with digital television. And I like to separate transmission from reception. The government is mandating that we transmit digitally. Again, this is for engineering purposes. It is a very efficient, effective way, far more efficient, effective way to transmit. The consumer will have many choices as to how they receive it. They could spend anywhere between $150 for a set-top box to a $30,000 widescreen, high-definition digital receiver. In all events, they will receive the benefits of digital television. That's an introduction, and I think after Maynard shows you some samples of what digital television would be like, it would be a good time to get some more specific questions about how it'll affect the users and how it'll affect the broadcasters.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, again, I'm Maynard Orme, Oregon Public Broadcasting. It's really a pleasure to be here. I would like to spend a few minutes just sort of setting the stage and then show you some of the applications that we're doing. I guess I may be overly simplistic here, but I want to make sure that we all start with on the same platform. First of all, we came mainly to talk about digital technology. Even though we run an analog service, our job now is to build two services, a complete comprehensive digital service side by side parallel with our analog service. So we have to do both at once, and as Bill mentioned, we're required by the FCC to meet those deadlines. So, in just thinking about digits, and I think this concept has always helped me, and that is it's just simply a sea of zeros and ones that you could do anything you want with. You can parse them out in any way, shape, or form. So it's our job to figure out what the user wants and how to go about that. And for the first time in history, really, we have an opportunity to take advantage of the multiple intelligences that are out there, because everybody learns in different ways. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Howard Gardner at Harvard, who talks about multiple intelligences and the various ways people learn differently. This is an opportunity now for people to put together a scheme for the way they want to learn and to design their own learning environment. So that's, to me, what is so exciting. Secondly, this is all about convergence. Yes, we're used to talking about computers and television and radio and all that, but it really is a matter of developing a transparent way in which the user can receive information where they don't even know where it comes from. It's simply there, they can receive it. So it's all about, in a sense, design and architecture. I think the third issue for me is the bandwidth, which is about how fast can you send information, what kind of information can you send, and what's the quality going to be. Now, with Oregon Public Broadcasting, because we have a special niche, I think our concentrations have been on the quality of our service, education, and localism. We are, in Portland, the only local television station. All the rest are, the corporate headquarters are somewhere else, and that's really true in most cases. The public television station is the only local station in the market. So our commitment to the community is very high. And so our interest in looking at how we converge these various applications is to do it in a way in which our local users can take advantage of it. Now, so you get the concept is there, and Oregon Public Broadcasting is really two things. We are a high-quality content producer. We produce now, believe it or not, about I think we're ranked third now in the PBS system in terms of the number of programs we produce for PBS primetime. So we're doing that a lot. We are also, of course, a distributor, and you, in this day and age, you have to be both. I mean, you look at how many billions of dollars Disney spent to buy Cap Cities and Westinghouse CBS. I mean, they all spent billions to get the services that we have. That didn't really cost us anything as far as the FCC licenses were concerned. Then the third issue is really all the equipment costs, and we're in the middle of an intensive capital campaign to get that. But it all boils down to that nothing else matters. What really matters is what you put out there. So this is, and then the only holdbacks, the only issues that we have to deal with, which are substantial, are the political, the legal, and the technological issues, which eventually get us to the creative issues, which is all about content development. So this is all an effort to develop these services. And I want to show you today a couple of things that, of the many things that are being done, that will sort of help explain how this might work. So Mary Caroline Cravens is with us from OPB and will help us through this. This first thing you're going to see is a piece on Itzhak Perlman and how a lesson in music can be vetted. I picked this one because music education and arts education in the schools are things that are being defunded. This is a way in which perhaps these can be utilized in the school.
What about it?
It's the same.
Thank you.
Jeff, just a dad.
I bring a lot of prizes on a broad range of subjects, even if you live home.
What sometimes what you do is you start it by already pressing down.
Just to carry that idea further, the technology exists today. We've demonstrated it. You could have, for instance, Andre Watts in New York City doing a piano masterclass, have the piano in a room in any place in the country, and he can then demonstrate on the piano where he is and have the keys in the room on that piano go down as the students see what he is doing and stand over the piano and watch what he's doing and see him at the same time. I mean, this is powerful technology where you can use the best in the world to help children, as an example. That's just one of many examples. The next piece I want to show you is something that we are doing, which I think is very important in the area of streaming video. Basically, this is converging television and the computer using, in this case, the example's Oregon Field Guide, where we are involving about 20 other stations around the country to create, in a sense, a new rubric called American Field Guide. It will have as many as 1,200 individual 3 to 7 minute pieces on streaming video, all cataloged and indexed, so that anybody around the country who wants access to that can do it on their own time. And I'll just show you a little bit on that. We are just developing this now. It will be finished in June. We just got this grant a month ago, so we're just beginning this process. Basically, you will aggregate this to collect the material for local outdoors programming that can be used locally and designed locally by the individual webs at each station. And it creates additional value for us by doing this with the Oregon Field Guide, where we can stream it and have it ready for people. And we are working with Virage Video, which is a storage company that will help us develop the way in which this storage technology can work. We also have a great teacher resource capabilities here. We're developing 20 original lessons correlated to national content standards, and we'll provide teachers with additional correlation as well. Now, this is an example, and again, it's just rough now because we're in the throes of it, where you can go on, click onto the American Field Guide site, and then parse your way through. Say, for instance, you were interested in birds, and you could access a section on birds, and out of that 1,200, there might be you know, 20 or 30 pieces on birds. And the teachers could access it, the children could access it, parents could access it, and even go to a forum if somebody is interested in doing that, and link to other websites as well, and then click on the streaming video and have that video there to look at. Yeah.
Are you saying that, let's say, if a teacher uses this in a classroom today, and there's a homework assignment, the student could go home?
Yes.
And tap in?
Absolutely.
To this very thing and continue?
It's all there to be had. In other words, it's cached in a database, and the student can go home and just access it as they want. For instance, whatever the assignment would be, whether it's birds, wolves, animals, plants, anything, there will be all these examples. In addition to this site, which will be the very first PBS site that combines both PBS and the local stations in doing work. We've done two other sites, one on Julia Child and one on, let's see, what was the other one? I'm trying to remember now. It was a NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. But those are individual stations working on streaming video. This is a combination of, well, as I say, 20 stations around the country that are aggregating resources. So, yes, it could be accessed.
When did you say this will be?
This particular, and this is I want to emphasize, Chairman Duncan, that this is an experiment. But we will have 1,200 pieces up in June. So this, we will put this online in June. So that for instance, the fall semester, and there will be no charge for it. I mean, it's just simply there for students to access. And we will have all the rights for the programs to do that. So it's just a rich way of developing content on demand.
Will you be showing something else along this line? Or could we back up so that Courtney can see this?
No,
just from,
I'm fine. No, you're fine.
Well, this is pretty interesting.
Well, and this is just one of several curriculum areas that we can do. This is just the first one we tackled.
They can have this on the television school, for example.
Right.
And then the student could go home at night, and there's homework. You could tap into that same thing.
Off the computer database, right.
The senator is smarter than I was giving credit for.
Right. the trick here, of course, is all about bandwidth. Okay. The trick here is all about bandwidth. The bandwidth capabilities are growing like mad, so the quality of this will get better and better. But right now it's pretty good. And when you're looking at it on a small screen, you don't have to have the same powerful database that you would, say, on a high-definition television. So it's just, you know, you're close at it. So it's pretty good quality. And then you can actually download that on your own computer if you have the space to do it. But you can also access it through the web. Okay, why don't we just continue then? That was it? Okay, that's fine then. Let's move on.
You know, I was just telling the chair.
Okay, thanks.
Well, chair, Mr. OPB, that more than the whole class could actually get on there. At least a large number could actually get on at the same time.
They could, and the advantage here is that they can all work at their own pace.
Well, but the point is, at night, let's say, because my boys constantly get calls about homework.
You know, absolutely.
That's right. They could literally get on this thing and start to deal with each other. South Salem, West, you see what I'm saying? They could do that too. So I just wanted you to know even that. You probably didn't know that. But they could do that as well,
right,
in addition to doing this.
And the server technology is rich enough that they can enter at any different time they want.
Right, so that's right. Interrupt. They get mad, they get upset. I'm out of here.
They're out, right. Or they're happy, they stay and watch.
You could.
Yeah. I wanted to talk just about a couple of other experiments that we are doing. We're working with Lucent Technologies on a fiber. This is because this is all converged. I want you to really think about that we're just more than a broadcaster now. We're a content developer and a distributor, as I said, so that it doesn't matter particularly what medium we work in. But in this case, we're using strictly a fiber technology that you can then, like the Itzhak Perlman piece, you could be sitting down at your computer and through a fiber connection pick up what you wanted while at the same time being on our website. For instance, if you're in a video conference as many as 16 different sites, you can put each video of that site on your screen so you could have 16 different videos and see each person at each site in a video conference. That's one technology we're working on. Another one is simply using the data that's left over after you broadcast high definition or standard definition television over the air in a business-to-business application. The company we're working there with is Wave Express, and we're doing some experimental demonstrations there. We're also working with a group called Metropolitan Area Networks to do broadcast applications that go back to the desktop so that you can actually take a broadcast segment and then put it back on the desktop. And then something that we're doing internally, which I'm really excited about, is that we're taking our website and through a back-channel phone line able to converge it on your television set so that you can be watching, say, an Oregon Field Guide or any program you want, and then go right to our website and pull up the teacher curriculum materials as the program is being run. Put it in a corner of your screen and see the curriculum materials as they're going, and get additional information while you're watching the program at the same time. So it's all nested in one way. You don't care as the user whether it's broadcast or whether it's coming off the web or whatever. All you want is the information the way you want it. And so this is all efforts to make that happen. We have another technology called Dotcast, which also puts data on the screen, on the analog screen, so that you can receive information that way. I could go on and on about all the projects we're doing. That's just three or four of many, many we're doing. But all I can say is our mantra is experiment, because we don't know exactly how all this is going to turn out. I was just at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. There were 1,200 exhibitors, each one with their own way of solving these problems. And so it's up to us as the content developers to figure out how all this works and how we can use it to the benefit of the user. So that's really kind of it in a nutshell. I want to leave some time for questions. I'm sorry, Bill, you?
I just had one kind of closing remark. Each of us have used the word convergence several times. And I think if you wanted to look at the two examples of Maynard Bot and what we're doing and what digital is going to bring. I went to the Consumer Electronics Show last year. I didn't make it this year. But the thing that is exciting is that the 5 years ago, Internet and television were this far apart and had different capabilities. Television had the quality of video, but it was absolutely sequential. You had to wait to see what they were going to show you. Internet was totally discretionary, but it was this crummy little screen and the slow download. What you're going to find 5 years from now is they will be basically the same, indistinguishable in what you're doing. The exciting thing about the examples that we saw with Itzhak Perlman is people will not need to get a brand new computer, a $30 a month DSL connection to get these quality of services. They will be able to buy at a relatively modest price. An article I read was joking that price wars have started before the products have even practically been invented. Panasonic will say, I'm going to do this for $800. Sony will say, we're going to do more than that for $400. Somebody else is going to do more. A household in Eastern Oregon with only rabbit ears on their television will be able to buy a converter box and effectively, depending on how fancy converter box they want to get, will be able to enjoy these internet-like interactive services. They will not have to pay both the equipment cost and the monthly service costs that people do now to get exceptional internet services. And that's going to be part of this transition of public broadcasting.
Also built into these black boxes, either if you're on cable or off the air, are things like TiVo, where you won't have to buy special machines. And you'll merge DVDs, TiVos, everything will be done in one box ultimately. So you can just have access the way you want to have it. Anyway.
Is that clear?
It's just the most fascinating time you can imagine.
When's that next show?
Have a lot of fun.
Pardon me?
When's that next show that you said you missed the one this year?
Oh, the Consumer Electronics Show.
Yeah.
You just
They're
missed
in
it.
January. They're first part of January. They are the most amazing thing you'll ever do because, as an example, and you probably heard about things like Kerbango, where you got a connection through a radio service to your computer that can bring you 10,000 radio stations around the country, around the world. Not that you want that. But that you can just design this any way you want. And what is the big rage now is home interconnectivity, where you could be in your house and through your own radio frequencies access through your stereo at great quality the local station in Moscow or wherever, not just a little box that sounds kind of crummy. I mean, first-class quality signals that connect you to the world in a big way. I mean, it's really quite fascinating what's going on.
Another example, when I was there a year ago, they had a product called AOL TV, and that was already a step to converge television service with everything you now get on your computer as an AOL customer. And this would be something you set on top of your TV, again, at a price point far below what a household has to pay now for a personal computer. And you can have the internet, the shopping, the email services of AOL, and use it as a to select which television shows to watch, and also as a directory to tell you when they're on.
I mean, today when I travel, I listen to OPB radio wherever I am, wherever
you
I
do?
Am in the country. You bet. I just plug it in through my computer, connect to our website, get my streaming audio, and just listen to it.
You listen just to OPB?
Yeah, pretty much. I do occasionally watch commercial television, but I'm and radio, but I'm an OPB junkie, I must say.
Mr. Chair, you're going to get tired of me beating this drum, as is Marjorie, but I do want to ask him about children and kids, if I can.
Yes, sure.
And I saw, the only reason I keep going in and out is there's Boys and Girls Club officials in the buildings today, and they want me to meet them because of bills, so I apologize, I'm out there.
No problem.
But it just reminds me of something. If this has been said by you, Supreme Chair, then I'm sorry because I haven't been out, and I'm sure about Senator Messer's going to disagree with me. I do hope that since the example that was given to me upon my return here by the chair wanting you to redo the tape was that, you know, did you know that kids can be in school and at night they can go and do certain things with their homework by your thing here? And maybe you've already done this, Mr. Swindells, Mr. Orm, that you bring into your studios or you bring into your I notice you're with the Purple...
Purple Mountain Media?
Purple Media, which I... That's interesting. I was looking at the color of some of the things that were on the screen. That you bring in just the elementary schools and the middle schools and the high school kids, and you just bring them in, and you let them design without a bunch of adults telling
mm-hmm,
them.
Mm-hmm.
You let them go with their creative juices and their minds, because it's my opinion, and nobody agrees with me here. Did you already say that to them?
No, but
I'm
going to
finish.
Let
me finish, please, Mr. Chair, because you're always going to steal my ideas. I don't believe anybody in this room can relate to kids in this world when
That's
it comes
right.
to this stuff. I mean, they can't think like they have. They're way ahead of anybody in this room. I don't care how good you are in this stuff. They're at a level that's unbelievable. They and they alone can only visualize what's out there. We cannot. No person my age or even a lot younger than me can do it. They're I've watched them do things that are unbelievable. And so their minds and where they're at and how to communicate to them, it should be almost left up to them. So I really hope... And even though you do this, and this is for kids, and this is how they think, they can do things and think in this world like we cannot. And I've had so many people who are very good at this stuff, your age and younger, who had a daughter all of a sudden walk in and put together this whole big system, and they're sitting there, and they just don't understand how their daughter can do it. Or like my sons get on the thing, and I have an 18 and a half, a 13, and a 15-year-old, and I just leave the house. Because I do not know what they're doing. I do not know how they're doing what they're doing. And when I ask them something, they make me feel like a complete doofus. So I'm just saying, I hope that you'll do that and not be afraid to do it and not try to micromanage it. I know you're very learned, Mr. OPB and Mr. Swindell. I know you know all there is to know about this. But I would say you ought to think about doing something like that. I'm trying to get him to do something in front of this committee where we go to somehow we do something with kids in here that's unbelievable. They just go. I'm not sure that we understand how to do it because we just can't think like they think.
Senator Cardi, I have a response. I want to encourage your remark.
No,
one thing I think Maynard and I have made this presentation so many times, we leave out some key things that we've heard so many times we take for granted. The conduit for information in digital television will be approximately greater than four times wider than with analog television. One problem we have now is everything we do is done sequentially in 24 hours. When we want to do a program for teachers in the classroom, we put that on the air at 2:30 in the morning when it's not competing with Sesame Street or McNeil NewsHour or McNeil Air or Mashpee Theater. And then the teacher who knows how to use their VCR, they collect it and then they show it sequentially to their class. We will be able to have all-day programming available for all-day children's services, all-day preschool services, all-day adult education, and it will be interactive. So we will have great capacity to run an experiment just like you suggested, where before now it would be just absolutely unreasonable because we'd have to crowd out. We have these things we have to do in order, and there's going to be so much latitude in the kinds of things we'll be able to do, and we'll have the capacity that's very economic capacity. So that is just direct benefit of digital television.
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, let me too respond. And I agree with you. And we do work with younger folks on this, and we are going to do a lot and are doing testing to see where these things work. Clearly, our older audience can identify with the old style, and we understand that. But in developing new audiences, you're exactly right. But I also would throw a caution out there, and that's this. One of the things I saw at CES was a thing called Xbox that Microsoft is doing. It is the most fascinating video game technology you will ever see. A high-definition television where the kids control the way these characters move in the most... I mean, even I, who don't do video games, was captivated by this. But my problem is, and this was done by very young folks, is that often at that age, the models that they use are relatively simplistic. And what I mean by that is kill or be killed. All these Xbox video games are nothing but about death, about, you know, power and shooting somebody, killing somebody, stomping somebody out. I mean, it was funny to watch, but I have to ask myself, where's the educational value? So you really need, I think, both of us. I think you need a combination of people designing and building these content pieces, because you really want it to be something of value to the kids. And frankly, I was horrified at what I saw. I was exhilarated at the quality, but I was horrified at the content.
Well, I wasn't, Mr. Chair, I wasn't trying to say we get into video games.
Oh, no, no, but I'm saying the point here is that anything, that you have to manage it in an appropriate way, I guess that's all I'm saying.
But, yeah. Senator, I suffer from the same embarrassment you do. I am, amongst my peers, would be considered extremely computer literate. And my 12-year-old daughter has her own homepage, which she designed herself, and I couldn't design a homepage on the Internet.
No, that's not, yeah, there it is.
Mr. Chair, well, Senator Courtney, my daughter works at MTV, and she gets me straight all the time about what young kids can do, so I appreciate your comments.
Well, I think we will be following up at some point. We're trying to think of something that would be kind of statewide kind of thing we could do to involve young people and just
okay.
Challenge us.
Mr. Chairman, if I may close on that statewide comment, our operating budget, which allows us to broadcast currently statewide, will be ahead of the front of the legislature. Also, we are going to be presenting a bill for a lottery bond to do the digital conversion, which will specifically allow communities and households outside the Willamette Valley access to the new digital content that's going to be available, which otherwise they may not get for a great deal of time. If we're forced to raise the entire conversion budget privately, as we're raising the majority of it, we would not be able to serve those communities for a long time.
That's great. Well, other questions? Yes, sir.
Yes, that reminds me, Chair, looking at your map, Mr. Swindell, since you just referred to, is this sufficient, this map, in terms of your ability to reach whatever?
I think that map demonstrates that we reach about 95% of Oregon's population. The extreme southern area around Medford is serviced by KSYS, another public broadcaster, and we have some spillover benefit. We are actually the primary server to southwest and the southern edge of Washington.
But my point, yes, I'm reading your microwave relay, your TV. Is this the blue... Well, whatever lines you choose to use, are they sufficient, or are additional lines needed? I guess you said 95%, so I guess that means the lines are sufficient.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, we do have a major problem, and it is this, that our translator services are being picked off by religious broadcasters, because what they will do is to go into Class A services. So we are required to upgrade our transmitter and transmitter services in many of these markets in order to avoid being pushed out. We've got a couple of them we're dealing with right now. So that is an issue we are dealing with. But in terms of coverage in Southern Oregon, KSYS does carry our local services, the programs we produce. In addition, we program their station for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you explain that again, you say you're being kicked off with your translator. You mean that they're powering at a greater level in those areas? I don't understand that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I was going to give the layman's. I heard Maynard say that, and I thought I've got to jump in. There are,
we've got Voice of God here. We also have the Voice of OPB, and they're competing.
Yeah.
I mean,
we have five major transmitters for television.
Right.
And those are licensed, and they are a dominant presence. And then at our discretion to extend our signal, we have translators, and we have 39 translators across the state.
Okay.
Those translators don't have the rights in the FCC's eyes. So we make the risk investment because we want to service the community. Someone can buy a transmitter in that community, and our translator has it just knock us off the air in that community.
So what we do is look at other ways in which we can service that, especially in radio with a Class A transmitter or a larger transmitter on television.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Another question. Well, thank you very much. This
is our pleasure.
Very enlightening afternoon. And
Mr. Chair,
thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
I wish I'd gone with you in January. I might have learned a lot.
If you're interested, I'll get you information on the next round. It's always the first week in January for about 3 days, and there's a convening of over 1,200 OEMs, they call them, original equipment manufacturers, plus programmers. So you really need to focus what you're going to look at there because it's overwhelming.
Okay, well, thank you, folks, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We may want to get in touch with you again before this.
Okay, it'll be our pleasure.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, members of the committee, you know, our agenda, we have an LC draft 2546 before us, dealing with tax credit for advanced telecommunications facilities. And I believe this is Senator Nelson's draft. And I'd like to introduce it as a committee bill. Excuse me. I better go into a work session. We're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move we introduce LC 2546 as a committee bill.
Senator Metzger moves we move LC 2546.
The vice chair was not listening to the cue.
Yes, yes. Is there any discussion? Any objection? LC 2546 is introduced, and you will take care of it for us, okay? Next week, we'll be hearing, well, I don't know how many of these we'll be hearing, but for sure, we'll have Senate Bill 202. The library groups from around the state will be in town that particular day, and this bill has to do with libraries, and so as a courtesy to Senator Nelson, who's asked for it, we're scheduling 202 for next Thursday.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, do you plan to work publicly here and work at the same day?
You'll be truthful. I've not spent that much time with
well,
it yet.
I'm just saying. I mean, it's
it would be nice. Is there? Marjorie, have you read it?
Not yet.
I've not read the bill.
Okay, so. I know it's simple enough that we could literally, since it's the library day.
Let's put down the possible work session.
Okay? Yeah, I think
that.
Yeah,
and that gives us a chance.
Well, I don't know if it's in the bill. Maybe it's just too complicated, but it'd be a great thing. Do you want to make a commentary to hear it and put it out that very day?
Then we get
a press release statement that I would put together, and then we do a press conference, which I, of course, would want to be the one who would be.
Would you mind moving back over here closer to me, Senator, before you do that? Okay. By the way, just for your information.
Are we still on the record?
Yes, we're on the record, yes. I'll close the work session. Information.
Did we close the hearing?
No.
No.
The work session.
No, so we're still. I closed the work session.
So you want this on the record?
Yes, this is just information for you. As you know, in the House, you have a sort of a concurrent. You have a substantive committee, and there are three members on that substantive committee in the House. They also serve on the Ways and Means e-governing subcommittee of Ways and Means. And they meet Monday and Wednesday as a substantive committee. And Tuesday, I might have it reversed.
Yeah.
Anyhow, a Monday, Wednesday, and a Tuesday, Thursday as a Ways and Means Committee, and as a it is Monday and Wednesday because I sit as Senator Yee, and I sit as members of the Ways and Means section of that. Okay, and so we are hearing,
Mr. Chair. Can I just ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you feel happy about what you're about to say on the record?
Oh, yes, yes, I'm very.
Oh, okay. Go
this
ahead.
Is just reporting to you so you're knowledgeable of what's going on. Right now, we are hearing the IRMD aspect of the DOS budget in the Ways and Means section of that particular committee. And so we're getting the reports from them and what's fit in. So I'm just learning our committee that that is going on right now. I don't know what aspect of that you might want to have here for information. And I'll try to keep you up to date from my role in Ways and Means with this, with our substantive committee. And so that's how we're working at this particular point. Any other questions about the organizational structure of? Well, we're not having a joint JLIMT committee, right? Is there anything else to come, Marjorie? Is there anything to come before the group today?
I understand we're going to meet. This is regular. Every
yes.
Two says this
yes.
Is reasonable. Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Right. And so next Thursday, we will have the library people will all be here.
Right.
So we're going to convene at 1 o'clock.
Right.
And hope to see all of you that.
And really, if the bill is the kind of bill that we can, despite what was said on the Senate floor yesterday, if you remember, if we can do it, do it.
She'll do it. So we'll have it listed as possible. Work session.
Once, everyone.
Okay.
There.
Ladies, thank you very much for staying with us.
Do you have a connection?